At Nutrafol, we don't just help your hair, we help your body grow it. Because it's never just about your hair. It can be your job, or your deodorant, or your lunch, or just normal life. That's why our whole body approach targets the key root causes of hair thinning. Discover your root causes and why we're the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement brand at Nutrafol.com. That's Nutrafol.com. These statements have not been approved by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease paid for by Nutraceutical Wellness, Inc.
Welcome, everyone, to Couch Potato Diary. Happy Wednesday. My name is Peter Klein. Thank you very much for tuning in today. Busy show. We're going to continue our UFC 300 preview, looking at the legacy of the Ultimate Fighter. We're going to look at a wild night in the NHL last night, how the standings shake out, and we're going to start with a busy night in the National Basketball Association as playoff races. We know the teams that are in the playoffs and the play-in. We just don't know how it's going to shake out, and last night took us a lot closer to figuring all of that out, and I guess both in the NHL and the NBA, figuring out playoff positioning so key this time of year. So let's get into it and talk some basketball. The Golden State Warriors aren't dead yet. What a performance last night against the Los Angeles Lakers. Now, they're basically locked in as the 10th seed going into the play-in tournament. But this was a nice reminder of what they can do. And I mean, look, when Draymond Green hits 5 threes in the first half, you should win that basketball game, all right? That should be over and done with. But everyone on Golden State was on fire in this game. Klay was hitting from three. Peyton had a three. Steph. Kuminga knocks down a three as well. This team was just letting it rain and putting on just a fantastic offensive performance. And I don't think they'd be able to do this against Minnesota. I don't think they'd be able to do this against Denver. And if they did against Denver, I still don't think it would matter. But when we're looking at just the play-in tournament here, this is still a team that can probably get through and get into the playoffs when the offense is clicking like this. When you have Klay and Curry and Draymond hitting from three, Draymond just contributing. And this is another example of how important Draymond is and how that suspension in the early part of the season, I think, really cost this team because he is so important to what they do on both sides of the floor. Obviously, he's an all-defensive player, like an all-time great defensive player. And offensively, yes, 5 3-pointers is very anomalous, but like his vision of the floor and his playmaking ability does help give them another distributor out on the floor. And to not have that and try to figure out how everyone fits on this team on the fly without him and dealing with some injuries with Chris Paul as well, probably knock this team back. I don't know if they're finishing sixth this year or anything like that, but they'd be in a better spot than having to win two road games just for the right to get your head bashed in by Minnesota or Denver in the first round. But this game really did show what this team can do when they are firing on all cylinders. And it showed that there is still that type of an offensive explosion in this team. So, again, it's not going to be easy, and I'm not saying they're even going to win a round, but I do think this put a bit of a, in the Los Angeles Lakers, who they will probably face at some point, either in the 9-10 game or in the 8th place game. That has to be a bit of an eye-opener for them. And this was a really tough loss for the Lakers. Their chance to leapfrog the Kings, who lost to Oklahoma City, and we'll talk about that in a second, their chance to get into the 7-8 game, they had that opportunity. They're still only half a game back of the Kings, but that just gives you so much more wiggle room. It would set up an all-time great matchup. I mean, they're getting one anyway. Lakers-Warriors probably in the 9-10. But right now, if the playoffs were today, it would have been, if they would have won, it would have been them and the Suns in the 7-8 game. So LeBron and KD in the 7-8, and the loser probably has to face Steph in the next round. My goodness, what a story all of that would be. It also shows the Lakers have, like, obvious flaws, right? And this is not going to be a podcast that is breaking any news. The Lakers have some troubles offensively, but they controlled the paint in this game, and it didn't matter. When it gets into a shootout, this Lakers team just doesn't have the guns to be able to do that. And it is still so wild to me that you get an all-NBA season from LeBron, an all-NBA-type season from AD, who admittedly was not in the lineup for this game, but I don't think he's going out there and blocking Draymond 5 times from three. And you're still stuck in this play-in. Also, you've had a phenomenal season from D'Angelo Russell, like beyond what we could have assumed best-case scenario would have been, and Reeves has been fine, and you still are stuck in this area. It's It like again, this has been talked to ad nauseum because of them being the Lakers and all of that. But this I thought was a bit of a like, maybe us just having LeBron and AD isn't going to be enough to just steamroll through these guys and get into the playoffs and go up against a Denver team who we really made work for four games, or a Minnesota team who doesn't have the experience we have. This was kind of a, I think, a bit of an eye-opener for the Lakers in a spot that they really needed a good performance in. The Pelicans play their way out of the play-in area. They survived a wild shooting game from Portland, especially in the first half. It was nice seeing Scoot making a few plays. His playmaking was on display, hit a couple threes as well. Ayton hit a couple shots as well. Welcome back to, I was going to say relevancy, but no. But at least welcome back to competent basketball for a day to DeAndre Ayton. But then McCollum and Zion stepped up. There were a couple of other bench players that helped out for the Pelicans, but this was a couple of big players stepping up in some big time moments. And Zion has proven that he can get back to at least close to what we thought he was going to be and be that guy who can carry this team kind of on his back. They still don't have Brandon Ingram, and that still hurts them a lot. There was a lot of times where scoring became a bit of a slog at some points, and that's against Portland. So this isn't a game where it's like, okay, well, Pelicans are here. Watch out. Who do they get? Oklahoma City? The Pelicans in three. Don't even bother with the fourth. That's how dominant it's going to be. But this is a game where they face some adversity. Zion pulls them out of it, and out they go, out of the play-in, which is going to be so important to get a couple extra days for Ingram, to get Zion a bit of rest and not have to play in that rigorous type of a schedule. That's going to be very important for them. We mentioned before the Kings lose to Oklahoma City. Their injuries have just really sapped this team. Herter is out. Monk is out. Ellis steps up with just 1-3 after another. He was averaging 5 points a game. He passed that on two shots as he made his first three. I think he made his first four threes and really helped them out. De'Aaron Fox was hitting from distance. Then in the second half, SGA basically just decided they weren't going to lose this game, and he adds to his MVP resume in a big-time way. He comes up with a big steal. He was hitting big shot after big shot. It was just so impressive watching him attack Sacramento. And I still think Jokic is the MVP, but I do think SGA would be second on my ballot right now, given what he has done with this group and helping them pick up a big-time win to keep them in range-ish of a one, maybe a two seed in the Western Conference here right now. Shifting over to the East, and even in a win, the Bucks still lose. We will start with the big story. It's obviously the end of the game, or toward the end of the game, end of the third quarter. Giannis goes down, and for a team that has been limping to the finish to see their star player literally limping off the court, initially, honestly, it's weird, but seeing him limp off the floor was kind of a good sign, because when he first goes down, it's non-contact, and you're immediately thinking Achilles, and that would be devastating for the next two seasons for the Milwaukee Bucks. And when he gets up and is able to put any weight on it at all, what we've seen from Achilles injuries in the past is that that wouldn't have been the case. So that was at least a major bullet dodged, but we still don't have a timetable for when he is going to come back. And it's so obvious, but going to say it anyway, if he's not in the lineup, this team ain't doing shit. They just simply don't have enough on this team, offensively or defensively, to be able to make any kind of noise in the postseason without Giannis. And the bummer for Milwaukee is that this comes on a game where things were starting to go right. They had four really bad losses in a row, and all of a sudden had the potential that they could fall to the four seed and end up playing the Celtics in the second round. And instead, they came out and played some really good ball. Lillard was drawing double teams. Lopez was hitting anything from three. They had some good defensive plays. Porta stepped up. Middleton had a quick impact in this game as well. So you were starting to see, and you were starting to see what it's supposed to look like for Milwaukee. And Boston, I don't really feel like their hearts were in it all that much. There was no Porzingis for them in this game. Tatum had some moments to try to drag them back, but it was just a strong performance for Milwaukee, who I think really needed that. Even though, like, that could have been anyone out there. The Washington Generals, who cares? It was just that Milwaukee could get a little bit of momentum going in their way that felt so good, until it didn't when Giannis goes down with that injury. And they're still facing some pressure. If they had lost this game, they would have been tied with the Knicks for the two seed. And you either lose home court advantage in the second round, or, like I said, a couple of big games from Orlando and the Knicks, and you're dropping down to the four seed, and you have to play the Celtics in the second round. That's a problem. Another thing that could be a problem for them is if they finish as the 2 seed, there's a very real chance they play the 76ers in the first round. And that's a problem because Joel Embiid is all the way back. He was incredible last night. Not the stiffest competition against the Detroit Pistons, but he played over 30 minutes. He didn't look gassed at all, and he had that game in the palm of his hand the entire way. It was phenomenal control. His passing was crisp. He was hitting from range. He was dominating in the post. He was everything you thought Joel Embiid could be, and he was it at the fullest of his capabilities. Again, it was against Detroit. But again, I don't think it matters. It's just to see that guy doing that. And if it's them against the Bucks in the first round, I don't know if I'm picking Milwaukee, to be perfectly honest with you. They did this without Maxey. So you notice the depth struggle a little bit. Embiid has 37. No one else on the team has 20. But this is still a team that I think is going to be a real problem for whoever they face in the postseason and a real wild card going forward. So we take a look at the updated standings, or at least I take a look. I'm not putting a graphic up, but take a look at the updated NBA standings. And as it sits right now, in the East, Boston has locked it up. They have a 14-game lead on the Milwaukee Bucks right now. Just for reference, the Denver Nuggets, who are tied for first in the West right now, have a 14-game lead on everyone else in the play-in. They're like, Houston is 16 games out. That is the difference between Boston and second place and Denver and 10th. It's insane how dominant they are. The Bucks are still in second. They are one game up on the Knicks for third, two games up on the Magic and Cavs in the 4-5 right now, and 2.5 games up on the Indiana Pacers. So as it sits right now, the playoff matchups that we would know would be Orlando against Cleveland in the NBA TV series and the Knicks against the Pacers. And we would get all the Reggie Miller clips for 5 games before the Knicks end up knocking them out. And then the Celtics and Bucks see who they face. The first play-in right now will be the 76ers and the Heat. The second one is locked in. It's the Bulls and the Atlanta Hawks. The Heat are a game and a half out of not being in the play-in, out of 6 behind Indiana. And the 76ers are still just a game back of the Pacers. Man, if they get into the 6-3 and end up getting the Knicks in the first round, gonna be a whole lot of pissed off New Yorkers about that situation. We know, again, the 10 that are in the NBA, huge game tonight out west with Minnesota taking on Denver. Winner of that game will be top seed in the Western Conference. Oklahoma City is behind that tie right now. They sit in third. Clippers and Mavericks are locked in the 4-5 pretty well. And then you have the scenario we talked about before. Pelicans are one game up on Phoenix for 6th right now, 2 games up on Sacramento. And now in that play-in area right now, the Suns and Kings would be the matchup, and Lakers and Warriors would be that matchup. But again, the Suns one game out of not being in the play-in, and the Lakers are half a game back of Sacramento for that 8th spot right now. So still a lot to be decided in the last couple of games in the NBA. Same thing goes for the NHL. It was a wild night last night. Let's talk about it. This one isn't playoff grind or anything like that, as a lot of the West stuff that needs to be shaken out wasn't overly affected last night. But Nathan MacKinnon adding to his MVP resume, it's down to him, McDavid, and Kucherov. And MacKinnon was electric with a hat trick last night. Each goal that he had, he basically just jumped on the puck, outskated everyone, and scored. His speed is elite. His finishing ability is basically that as well. He also has a great pass to set up a Lekkonen goal. I gave praise to the Stars the last show. This is still the most complete team in the NHL when they are going. That power play is crazy. MacKinnon is just him. He's phenomenal. Lekkonen has shown he can step up in the playoffs. Rantanen's very good. Drouin, awesome. Parise had a couple of moments in that game last night. And then on the blue line, Makar and Taves are the best defensive pairing in the National Hockey League. So this is such a complete hockey team right now, going up against the Dallas Stars, who grinded out a win last night, 3-2 over Buffalo. They had to work for this one, but I actually think that's a good thing for Dallas. The reason I like this one for the Stars is, A, they faced adversity, which you would rather they didn't, because that would mean they're winning so hard. But also, they had to battle back from that, and all the goals they scored were playoff-type goals. Robertson with a deflection after Hintz gets a steal, but Robertson, like, in front battling. You have Johnston just straight beats Dahlin in front and ends up getting the tying goal, and then Pavelski wins a puck battle down low, gets it to Tanev, goes to the front of the net, deflected in. Those are the types of goals that you score in the postseason. And so Dallas is already playing a playoff style of hockey. They add Tanev on the blue line. He's been great. Harley had an assist on the Johnston goal. I think it was the Johnston one. It might have been the Pavelski one, actually. But either way, his shot ends up getting deflected, and he's been great. And like I said before, people don't talk enough about how good Miro Heiskanen is. Ottinger fought it in this game. And that's the one thing where it's like, man, that kid's got to sharpen up a little bit to get into the postseason, or once we get into the postseason. But that was a big one for the Stars in just kind of proving it. But a lot of the focus right now is out east in that playoff race. The Islanders' big players came to play in a big game. They beat the Rangers 4-2. Barzal looked great. He drew a penalty shot like 8 seconds into the game. Bo Horvat had some dangerous chances all night. Palmieri looked good. He scores a goal. And Pageau had a chance. But the real difference maker in this game was Noah Dobson. He was noticeable basically every time he stepped out on the ice. And it felt like something dangerous was happening every time he had the puck in the offensive end. He was a game changer for them last night. And if he is going at that level, it kind of changes how you can maybe view this team. Again, they do not belong in the upper echelon in the amongst the upper echelon teams in the NHL or even Eastern Conference. If they finish third in their division, they are going to get shit whipped by Carolina in the first round. But I was very critical of them on the last show. I'm still kind of over it with them, but there's at least some pieces on this team where it's like there's danger in this lineup, and we know the style of play that they can bring, that this is going to be a bit of a miserable team to play in the postseason. The Capitals, with a massive win over the Red Wings, 2-1 over Detroit, puts them 1 point up on Pittsburgh and Detroit for the last wildcard spot, and this one was all Lindgren. Detroit was all over Washington early in this game. He held up long enough to allow Strome to get a chance and score, and then Ovi gets one short side, and that was basically ball game. Detroit was all over Washington this entire game. Larkin was exceptional in this game. The thing that concerns me a little bit on a Detroit standpoint is how easy it is to miss DeBrincat on a number of different plays. Like he does kind of just become part of the furniture a little bit out there. And I think they need him to be a bit more of a game breaker in the last week to 10 days of the regular season here, as they are trying to push to the playoff spot, because they needed someone else to step up in this game. They were creating chances and Lindgren was shutting the door. Like they played a good game, but they needed someone else to step up in this one. Ovi gets to 30. It's the 18th time he's done that in his career. It's the most in NHL history, which is funny because remember when this was a down year for Ovechkin? Oh yeah, just 30. Now he's going to be not even halfway to the top goal scorer in the league, but still, he was exceptional. You know who wasn't? The Philadelphia Flyers. A horrendous game last night for the Philadelphia Flyers in the middle of a playoff race, and that's how you show up. Like, that should almost disqualify them from playoff contention for how bad that was last night. No defense to speak of at all. They lost every puck battle, every race. And like I said, defensively, nothing. Everyone's focused on Suzuki, and Slafkovský is left wide open for a goal. Just absolutely no resistance to anything that Montreal was doing. An embarrassing performance. Good for Slafkovský to get his first career hat trick. Good for Montreal, they get 9. But what a dreadful, dreadful showing from the Philadelphia Flyers in a game that you absolutely had to have in this Eastern Conference playoff race. So that's the playoff race in the East. In as far as positioning goes, this was a real missed opportunity last night for the Bruins. I think this is actually a concern for them. They sleepwalked. They were lazy in this game against the Hurricanes. It was a bad loss. Carolina just dummied them this entire game. And I know they don't have a ton to play for right now, although I do push back on that a little bit. They are still probably going to finish first in their division. They're 3 points up on Florida with 3 to go. But they had a chance to move to within a point of the Rangers in the Eastern Conference. And I do think that means something, because as it sits right now, they are the 2 seed in the East. So they would get the first wild card team. That's Tampa Bay. The second wild card team is Washington. There is, I think, well, I respect what Washington has done, and Lindgren could steal a series, apparently. But there's pretty sizable gap because of how well Tampa Bay is playing right now, and facing them, and facing Washington, Detroit, Philadelphia, Islanders, whoever squeaks in to that second wild card spot. So winning the East this year, I think, actually comes with a pretty significant reward. And for Boston to just kind of ho-hum their way through that game, I think is really not a great thing. Also, need I remind you that this was a Boston team that cruised through the regular season, dominated their way to the President's Trophy, and were out in seven because that switch just couldn't flip the way it had for the Florida Panthers. Effort like this is really concerning from a Boston Bruins standpoint. Lastly, Matthews gets 66 last night. He had a fantastic game. He drives to the net, draws all the attention from the Devils' defense, leaves Domi with a great pass over to Bertuzzi, who finishes. I believe that opened the scoring, and then Matthews snipes one a little bit later on. He's so dangerous every time he touches the ice, and I know there's been discussion about what to do with him. Do you let him push for 70, or do you sit him for these last games? I'd probably at least sit him for the last one, maybe two for Toronto. I just think it is, like, we're at the point, we've established this season's incredible. Bravo. But he needs to be ready for the postseason. All right, it is time for our continuing coverage of UFC 300, a major milestone for the promotion, which leads you to think of, like, where we have come as a sport in mixed martial arts, and obviously the big tipping point to help us get to UFC 300. There might have not even have been a UFC 100 if not for The Ultimate Fighter. So today we look at the legacy of The Ultimate Fighter, specifically season one. The story of The Ultimate Fighter has been told a lot in many different ways, but one thing that is agreed upon is The Ultimate Fighting Championship, as we currently know it, probably would not exist at the levels that it does if it wasn't for The Ultimate Fighter Season 1. Some of this stuff is a little overblown. Like, they were auditioning or sending out audition things already for Season 2 before the Bonner-Griffin fight. So the whole, they signed the contract for The Ultimate Fighter Season 2 during the Bonner-Griffin fight. It might just be a bit of a tall tale, but still, like, there is no question that's the most important fight in UFC history. Because not, like, maybe Spike was already locked in, but the rest of the viewers weren't. And to see the steady rise in viewers as that fight is going on is truly remarkable. And so I do think that, like, maybe sometimes it's a bit overstated for the story, but this is still the most important television show for, like, any sport ever, really. When you think of, like, one thing really tipping a show off, really tipping a sport off, that was it. And when you look back at it, they really did have the perfect reality show cast. This is back, like, 2005. It was kind of perfect timing because you have the WWE, which was in a creative lull at the time. And you have a lot of wrestling fans who had come through the Attitude Era and were ready for more like that. And were not being, I would say, fulfilled from a sporting standpoint. And then they put The Ultimate Fighter immediately after Monday Night Raw. And that set the table for this growth. Because you had then some very frustrated and jaded wrestling fans going in and being like, oh, well, what's this? Oh, wait a minute. I can get some of the drama that I love from professional wrestling, and also get some of the violence that I crave from pro wrestling, for lack of a better term. And it's a little bit more legitimate. That, I think, was huge. And then, as I said before, they really had the perfect cast for it. When you think of 2005 and what that audience was looking for, you had, obviously, you had a bunch of guys who could fight. Like, there's no question about that. But you also had a lot of guys who were good characters for TV, both good and bad, for television. And so it was a real mix that I think just, it hit all the notes perfectly leading into this first season, The Ultimate Fighter. And the first real star of it was obviously Chris Leben. And he had a bit of a roller coaster ride, as he starts out as the annoying guy on the show. He's getting hammered. He didn't pee. He spritzed in Jason Thacker's bed in that first show. He's getting absolutely trashed. He's trash talking everyone in the house. But then on like 2.5 hours sleep, he goes into the first workouts and shows out and is just like an absolute badass in those. And so it established like, okay, that this guy is actually legitimately here and legitimately a weapon. And he still continued to trash talk and he was able to back it up until it came to one particular fight. But he was one of the first real stars of this show. And he ends up kind of, to steal the pro wrestling term, kind of turning babyface during the whole Koscheck Bobby Southworth situation. Those guys kind of played the perfect villains. They could trash talk, and then to a certain extent, they could back it up. With Southworth, you have him, he's part of the trash talk. He is absolutely part of some of the problems in the house. He is a little arrogant, I would say, when it comes to his abilities inside the cage. And then he has all this trouble making weight. And now, I will say, we've heard later that it sounds like none of the fighters on the show actually thought they were going to be fighting on the show. The way it was apparently pitched to them is that they would go through all these competitions and all these challenges, and then someone gets picked off every week until we get down to the finale, and then you fight. But that obviously was not the case. And so Bobby Southworth has to go through this terrible weight cut. Chuck Liddell is pissed at him the whole time. And it really does expose the world to the grind that is the weight cut, really, for the first time. I don't think anyone really, like, some people knew, obviously, but I don't know if there was a lot of people that the public sense anyway of what actually went into these fighters making their contracted weight. And so to watch that was drama in itself. To see how pissed everyone around him was while it was going on, kind of made you like be, oh yeah, this guy is, this guy doesn't want it. And then he picks the fighter who a lot of people kind of assumed was not necessarily the cream of the crop when it came to this in Loden Sinkaid, who unfortunately has since passed away back in 2019. After some struggles with bipolar disorder and also some struggles with PTSD from the military. But like Loden Sinkaid was not, he was up a couple of weight classes going into this. And so Bobby Southworth, this arrogant guy, picks him, knocks him out and celebrates it. So people turned on him pretty easily. And Koscheck was, and probably still is, extremely arrogant and very sure of his abilities in that cage, and then also was a bit of a needler. And so that whole situation brought out like the first real drama of the series, where there's the big blow up. Lieben is trying to get away from Koscheck and Southworth after Southworth makes a derogatory comment toward Lieben about the passing of his father, and it just absolutely sets off. And then Lieben's trying to get away from everyone, and Koscheck and Southworth go out, spray a hose on him, and that leads to a Koscheck-Lieben fight, which it feels like Lieben's drowning in that fight, the wrestling ability of Koscheck. And so again, you get kind of the guys who are portrayed as the heels in this, they get the win, and it just feels like the star is drowning because he just can't get anything going, and the heel is holding him down. So there's stories immediately in all of this that I think attract a pro wrestling audience that, again, they are coming in after Monday Night Raw. And then you have the fights that are backing things up. It was the perfect mix. And then you get one of the more famous moments of the show, and it's the Dana White, "Do you want to be a fucking fighter?" speech. And it becomes like this whole thing. It's a breakout moment for Dana White, who obviously becomes the biggest star coming out of this. Like before, you go watch some videos of Dana White speaking to like Goldberg and Rogan in the pre-Tough days, and he's still holding on for dear life to his hair, and he's awkward, and it doesn't come across. This finally kind of brought him into a bit more of the spotlight, and was a very interesting note here to see like that this guy really kind of transform into this almost character, but that this guy who would become the face of the Ultimate Fighting Championship. And so from a branding standpoint, it helped Dana White out as well, and it became this big kind of rallying cry that would like inspire people to fight. It is interesting also to note how kind of fitting it is, but maybe from a negative standpoint, that this becomes a thing, because it's talking about these guys not wanting to fight for free. Like the fighters were not getting paid to be on this show, aside from, or not being paid to fight on this show, aside from a $5,000 bonus if you ended up getting a finish. And so that, that does kind of become a sign of things to come for the Ultimate Fighter Fighting Championship and how they would pay their fighters and stuff like that. So it is a little unfortunate that this famous "do you want to be a fucking fighter" speech ends up being, you know, a sign of things to come and maybe isn't as grand and oh wow as many would make it out to be. The show also has some fighters who kind of change the perception of what a fighter is as well. Obviously, you have kind of the meathead stuff that I mentioned with Lieben and with Lieben, Koscheck, and Southworth, but you also have guys who I think kind of changed the perception of what being a fighter was, and you have a few, for those watching on video, cat making an appearance now, you saw the tail kind of go across there, but you have Nate Quarry, who approached things in such an intellectual basic undersells it quite a bit, but he was just like, yeah, I am here at Ultimate Fighter University and I'm looking to get an education. You have Kenny Florian, who's like, yeah, I didn't come from a tough background or anything like that. I just love to compete. And you have Diego Sanchez, who on the show is just out there. And didn't exactly reel it back in, post Ultimate Fighter either. But I think it kind of changed the perception of, oh, these are just a bunch of guys with tribal tattoos wearing Tap Out shirts and Affliction shirts and just beating each other's brains in. There's different types of people on this as well. I also think they had perfect coaches. Chuck Liddell becomes an absolute megastar out of this. And like he was always the one that when the UFC was looking to promote something, he was the guy at the front of it. But Randy Couture wasn't necessarily the obvious choice for this. He's not big or outspoken or anything like that. But again, he kind of starts to change the perception of mixed martial artists and the respect that you need to have. And this Captain America persona, and it's an amazing yin and yang with him and Chris Lieben on the show as Randy ends up being his coach and then having to defend some of these actions and stuff like that. But it built their pay-per-view perfectly, and it ended up showing two sides of what a mixed martial artist can be, and two sides of what this sport can really offer you. And then, obviously, the finale delivers. Griffin and Bonner is one of the great fights you will ever see. It's the most important fight in the UFC's history, and it's not particularly close. What these guys are able to do for the full fight, and then you get the moment after where Forrest Griffin wins the fight, and then Dana says, you know what, we're giving both of these guys contracts, and he ends up giving one to Stephen Bonner as well, and it is just such an amazing moment on this show, and such an amazing time for everyone. Now, it turns out like 8 guys from the show end up making it, but still, at this time, you kind of thought that only 2 guys were getting contracts and the rest of the guys are kind of fucked, and Bonner ends up getting the contract. Amazing moment, amazing theater, amazing drama, all of it just perfect. 100% perfect on that finale. And then you get, coming out of it, we didn't really know how good these fighters were. Right? Like, so it's like, should they get title shots immediately? And some of them would fail and some of them would go on to succeed, right? Like, Nate Quarry fights Rich Franklin and it's one of the legendary knockouts of the first era, or I guess of the post-tough era, leading up to UFC 100, where he gets just absolutely knocked out. And then, like, Florian challenges for a title. Sanchez challenges for a title. Forrest Griffin ends up winning the belt coming off of the show. So it legitimately created stars. Eventually, it starts to wear, right? Like, the format wears on people. The contracts are actually really restrictive. It is a 6-fight contract to fight in the UFC, but it's like $100,000 over 2 years and 6 fights. So when you spread it out, like, I would much rather have $100,000 over the next 2 years than not, but it's not like this life-changing thing or anything like that, and it's not what you would get if you were a top prospect coming into the UFC and able to negotiate your contract anyway. So the format kind of wore on people, that they didn't, a lot of MMA fans just wanted the fights. But I still think over time, this is an amazing way to build stars. Like, you look at what they did when they brought in a whole women's division, and Carla Esparza is on this show, and Rose Namajunas is on the show, and you have all these different fighters who kind of get their start. And that was right when I was introducing my wife to mixed martial arts. And so to have this show where she gets this background information and gets to know all of these fighters, that's what you're looking for in sports, right? In entertainment, in whatever. It is that personal connection. And I think The Ultimate Fighter still does a good job of getting that. It's just no one cares about it anymore. It's just kind of on there to fill a content contract, and that's about it. But I do think when done right, it is still an amazing way to build things up. And so the legacy of this show, you have so many amazing fighters who passed through this show at various points, right? Like I just mentioned Rose Namajunas, John Dobson, who is so much fun to watch. He passes through, right? Like in the early days, Forrest Griffin, Rashawn Evans, champions. Like I said, Florian, Sanchez, Nate Quarry, who was rather impactful. Michael Bisping makes his way through. You have like just so many. I'm leaving out a ton, right? Like Roy Nelson goes through the Ultimate Fighter. You have the Kimbo Slice season and all of that. So there were always these big names who were able to come through this. It was a great way to create stars out of guys who weren't in your promotion and introduce them with a ready-made fan base. It was a great way to bring a new fan base in, and it was a way to really change the game for the Ultimate Fighting Championship. And so as we sit here, as I'm recording this, on the cusp of UFC 300, there might not even be a UFC 100 if not for the Ultimate Fighter. All right, that's going to do it for the show today. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. Our UFC 300 previews continue tomorrow. I got a comment on one of the UFC videos I did asking like, hey, I haven't been around for a while, around the sport for a while, so what fights should I watch to kind of get back into it and kind of see what I have missed? So tomorrow I'm going to do the fights, I think it's going to be from UFC 250 to UFC 300, that are key in kind of defining this era of the Ultimate Fighting Championship. So we're going to do that, and we're going to look at other fight announcements that have been made over the next little bit. We're still going to follow all the playoff races in the NHL and the NBA. Also going to be looking at some Blue Jay stuff. That game is going on as I'm recording this right now, so we're going to have more on the Seattle series going into the show on Thursday. And then Friday, it's going to be full fight preview, the entire card. We're going to be breaking it down here on Couch Potato Diary. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. Make sure you like the video and subscribe. If you're listening, make sure you subscribe and leave a review, and I'll talk to all of you later.